Are you a good person? How would you answer that question? And if so, what is it that makes you good? Is it all of the things that you don't do? You don't steal, you don't murder, you don't drive more than 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, therefore you're a good person? Or do you have to actively do good things to be a good person? You help old ladies across the street. You volunteer. You do community service. You go to church. You give to charity. So you're a good person. There's a website that caters to students, and it asks them this question, are you a good person? And their responses are interesting. For instance, I would consider myself a neutral person, not a good person or a bad person. This is because I'm not selfish, greedy, or disloyal, but I'm not particularly merciful. I'm apathetic to some plights, and I wouldn't be against killing people if I thought they deserved death. Another says, I always thought I was a good person, but I'm obviously being punished for something. And then the next person says, ha, I don't think I'm being punished enough. Someone else says, I know I'm a good person because I only try to hurt people when they've given me a reason, and I forgive people when they've given me a reason. Someone else says, knowing myself, I know I definitely have the potential to do bad things, but I have good intentions. I actively try to help people in real life, says someone else. And I give to a few charities each month. I'm hoping to get into heaven. A couple of the more honest ones, maybe, say this. I wish I were a good person, and I try to be, but deep down I know I'm quite a bad person. And then there's this one. I can't be the only one who genuinely knows I'm a bad person. Are you a good person? And how much bad does it take you to make you a bad person? Maybe we're like the person who said, I'm a good person who's done some bad things. There was another survey that asked, what are some things that scream to other people, I am a bad person? And some of the top vote getters are interesting. Cutting in line, never accepting the blame for anything, not tipping, putting down mutual friends when they're not around because you know that if they do it to you or they do it to them, they'll do it to you. Treating those below them badly, be it employees, service workers, or children, throwing litter or cigarette butts out the car window, playing music audibly when you're in a public place, changing lanes without using your turn signal, not returning your shopping cart to the cart corral, thinking about what they will say next instead of listening to you, one-upping on anything and everything, and lastly, this one, constantly telling people you're a good person. That makes you a bad person. In Matthew 5, 6, and 7, Jesus talks about what it is that makes us a good person. And he gives us his understanding of morality and righteousness. Now, these three chapters, as we saw last week, are known as the Sermon on the Mount. And it's called that simply because Jesus goes up on a mountain and teaches the people spread out below. And this sermon is Jesus' vision of what it means to follow him and who we are to be as citizens of his kingdom. And one of the major themes of the Sermon on the Mount, a thread that goes throughout the whole thing, is this idea of what it means to be a good person. Jesus uses the term righteousness. Now, righteousness is doing what is morally right and legally just. It is to live in accordance with God's laws. In the sermon, for instance, Jesus promises blessing or happiness to those who have a hunger and a thirst for righteousness. He warns us against doing our righteous things or practicing our righteousness just to be seen by others. And he calls us to seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness as our highest goal, our greatest pursuit. And then all of the other joys of this world would be added as well. Now, let's say somebody there that was on the mountainside that day went up to Jesus and asked him, how good is good enough? And maybe that happened because in the first century, sermons like this usually weren't a one-sided dialogue with one person talking and an audience listening, but usually there was dialogue. There was give and take, question and answer, question and answer. And it's very possible that in this teaching on the mountain that somebody asked Jesus, well, how good do we have to be? How good is good enough? And Jesus gives an answer in Matthew 5:20 that is a seemingly impossible standard for righteousness. And it's our core verse for this week. We are in week 19 of Core 52. And so throughout this year, we're going through 52 of the most important, most significant Bible verses and how they're all tied together. And so we are in the New Testament now, in the Sermon on the Mount, and this week's core verse is Matthew 5:20. And here's how good is good enough, according to Jesus, Matthew 5:20. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, let me make that personal for me, okay? Dan, I tell you that unless your righteousness exceeds that, is greater than, is more than the scribes and Pharisees, Dan, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, do you hear that? To even enter the kingdom, Jesus says, your goodness, your morality, your righteousness has to exceed the scribes and the Pharisees. That's not what I want to hear, right? If these guys weren't good enough, then there is no way that I'm good enough, that you're good enough. How could we ever be good enough? Let's talk about the scribes and Pharisees for a minute. Now, the scribes, historically, were people who made written copies of the Old Testament for a living. In those days, there were no printers, there were no copiers. Somebody had to write those scrolls, all the scrolls that were in synagogues. If your family had a copy of the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, as a family scroll, right? Somebody had to write that. And it all had to be done by hand. And this is something that the Jews took very seriously. Because remember, they regarded this as the word of God. So they didn't just copy the text, all right? Scribes studied it thoroughly. They were to know it forwards and backwards, inside and out. They could tell you, for instance, how many words were in each book. They knew what the middle word in each book was. And this is how they ensured that their copies were accurate, all right? They would make a scroll, and they didn't copy a whole sentence at a time or even a phrase at a time. They copied it word by word by word. All right, now when it was all done, they would go through and they would count all of the words in that book. And if the count wasn't the right number, they knew that the scroll was inaccurate. Or they would find the middle word in the scroll, and if it wasn't the right word, then they knew there was a problem with that scroll and it would be thrown out. It was an ancient form of error correction. All right? And so that's how they ensured they made accurate copies. Now, by Jesus' day, you know, the scribes just didn't work in some room somewhere. You know, they had become respected religious leaders and community leaders. And then there are the Pharisees. Now, if you grew up in the church or you've spent any time at all in the church, then then you know the Pharisees as the perennial bad guys. They were the arch enemies of Jesus. But what we need to remember is that the Pharisees were guys who had devoted their entire lives to being good. And not just good, but perfect, right? If you were to go to ancient Jerusalem and you were to do a man-on-the-street survey, you know, who is righteous? Who's good people? All right? Everyone would agree it was the Pharisees. They were the definition of righteous. I mean, for them, being good was a full-time hobby. In addition to knowing the law, they had dozens and dozens of books to help them interpret the law, understand the law, and apply the law to any situation, any circumstance in life that might arise. Nobody was more righteous than these guys. Even the name Pharisee means separated ones, all right? They didn't want to be polluted or corrupted by the unclean masses. They were devoted to doing the right thing. They prayed 3 times every day, and we're not just talking about giving thanks for their meals. They fasted 2 times a week. They tithed everything. I mean, they would actually tithe the herbs in their garden. They would count out a tenth of their mint, a tenth of their dill, a tenth of their cumin, and they would bring that to the temple as an offering. They even had rules to keep them from accidentally breaking the rules. Rules for everything. The Sabbath day, that was a big deal to them. The Sabbath was the seventh day, Saturday. They weren't supposed to work. It was to be devoted to rest and to worship. And so they had all these rules to make sure that they didn't work. For instance, you couldn't take a bath on the Sabbath because you might splash water on the floor and then be guilty there of accidentally washing the floor, and that would be work. You couldn't move a chair on the Sabbath because as you drag the chair, it might furrow a line in the dirt and you'd be guilty of tilling the ground. Women weren't allowed to look in mirrors because they might see a gray hair and be tempted to pull it out. Interestingly, they didn't have the same rule for men. I guess the Pharisees were incredibly sexist as well. You couldn't wear false teeth because the false teeth weighed more than the allowable limit you were permitted to carry on the Sabbath. All right. They had 24 chapters devoted to these kinds of rules for keeping the Sabbath. Now, Jesus says, to even enter his kingdom, your righteousness has to exceed their righteousness. How does Jesus expect us to do better than these guys? How could we ever do more? Well, are you ready for the good news? Jesus isn't calling for a broader righteousness. He's calling for a deeper righteousness. Right? Jesus isn't asking for more laws, more do's, more don'ts, but he's calling for a change of heart. Jesus doesn't want you to do more. He wants you to be more. Now, the problem with the scribes and the Pharisees was, yeah, they had all of these rules, all of these do's and don'ts. Right? But these rules never were used to build a closer relationship with God, but they were used to build a bigger public image, a bigger ego, a bigger platform for themselves. And so they followed these rules on the outside, but inside, they didn't really love God. They didn't love others. All right? For them, the righteousness of their rule following was a matter of showmanship. It was performance art done for public acclaim and bragging rights. Look how good we are. Their rules focused on external compliance, but they never addressed the attitude of the heart. They used the rules to make themselves look good, at the same time manipulating the rules to get what they wanted. They were masters of malicious compliance, following the letter of the law, but never fulfilling its intent. And I'll share one of my favorite examples. I've shared this before, but it's too good. They had a rule that on the Sabbath day, you couldn't travel more than 3,000 feet from your house because that would constitute a journey and that would be work. And you weren't supposed to work on the Sabbath. Well, if the day before the Sabbath, say on Friday, you took a little bit of food and you stashed it 3,000 feet from your house, you could then go to that stash on the Sabbath and you could eat that food, and it would then, according to their rules, become an extension of your house. And then you could travel 3,000 more feet. And in this manner, Pharisees could travel as far as they wanted on the Sabbath day. And so they could successfully keep their rules, but they would never really fulfill the intent of the Sabbath. Missing the very object of what God wanted. And so when Jesus looks at their hearts, what he sees isn't a deep love for God. He doesn't see a love for their fellow man. He sees pride, arrogance, selfishness, right? They wanted everyone to think they were God's BFFs. But in their hearts, they really weren't interested in what God wanted at all. We're interested in what they wanted. So Jesus isn't asking us here to do more. He's asking for you to be different. Jesus doesn't want a greater degree of rule keeping. He wants a deeper motivation. Right? We need a goodness that changes our hearts, that changes us from the inside out, because the heart of the issue is the heart. Good enough isn't about what we do as much as it is about who we are. And therein lies the problem. We can't truly be good because there's something wrong with our hearts. Have you ever had a piece of equipment that was being eaten away by rust, or some wood that was rotting from the inside out, you know? It could look good on the outside. You could slap a fresh coat of paint over the rust or whatever, and you can hide it. You can disguise it for a while, but the rottenness, the badness that's on the inside will always show itself. It breaks, it crumbles, it falls apart. A couple years ago, we redid our decks. We power washed them, we cleaned them, and then we applied a new stain, a new seal, so everything looked good. But we had some boards that were rotting from the inside out. And so later that summer, I stepped on one of those boards, and guess what happened? My foot went clean through because it was bad on the inside. And that's our problem. My problem, your problem. There's something wrong with us on the inside. And you can add all of the rules that you want. You can try to force compliance from the outside. But as long as there's something wrong on the inside, you're never going to get at the heart of the problem. All right? This is what Jesus tells the Pharisee later on in Matthew. In Matthew 12, 33 through 35, here's what he tells them. Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, there's the heart, the mouth speaks. A good person produces good things from the treasury of a good heart, and an evil person produces evil things from the treasury of an evil heart. It's a heart issue. And it's not just the Pharisees that had this problem. It's me. It's you. Sin infects the very core of our being. Paul writes in the book of Romans, and he's quoting here in part from the Psalms, Romans 3, 10 through 12, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. All right. It's a universal problem. So our morality problem, our goodness problem is not a behavior problem. It's a heart problem. Jesus says this in Mark 7, 21 to 23, for from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, evil, slander, pride, foolishness. All of these things come from within. Right? And posting a few rules on a sign doesn't change that. Something has to be done at the very core of our desires. Right? And this is where Jesus is looking when he says that our righteousness has to exceed that of the scribes and Pharisees. And this brings us to the next very important truth when it comes to morality. And that is this. A good life comes from a changed heart. A good life comes from a changed heart. True goodness requires something to happen to your heart to make it good. All right? You can't change a person from the outside in. You have to change them from the inside out. And it is this heart change that Jesus is looking for. Our morality can't change unless there is a change of heart. There needs to be a heart transplant. Just because you follow a list of rules doesn't mean that your heart is in the right place. And any of us who have ever tried to strictly follow a list of rules knows how easy it is to fail. In the second half of Matthew 5, after 5:20, Jesus then gives us several examples of this deeper righteousness that comes from the heart, right? And Jesus begins this by quoting from the law or the Pharisees' interpretation of the law. He'll say, you have heard it said, right? And then Jesus shows how the law falls short of addressing the heart issue. But then Jesus takes it deeper. He'll say, but I say to you, and then he goes to the heart of the issue. And it begins with murder. And he shows how murder is nothing more than anger in full flower. Here's what he says, verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you, everyone who is angry with his brother is liable to judgment. Right? So even if you never commit murder, you never take someone's life, that doesn't mean you're good. If your heart is still filled with resentment, with rage, anger, right? Now, anger doesn't kill with a single pull of the trigger or one stab of the knife, but still it kills little by little with hurtful word upon hurtful word, one bitter act followed by another. We gash with gossip. We injure with innuendo. We stab with slander. We assault with accusations. With our anger, we murder hope, kill relationships, and slaughter dreams. Jesus then turns his attention to adultery. And he points out that affairs begin long before the actual act takes place. But adultery begins in the heart with lust. Verse 27, everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. In our hypersexualized culture, where we carry porn in our pocket and sex is used to sell everything from cars to potato chips, lust is so pervasive that everybody just regards it as normal. And is it any wonder that we have so much sexual dysfunction? Lust does more than unravel homes and relationships. It unravels our mental, emotional, and spiritual well-being. Jesus similarly gets to the heart of the issue, when it comes to keeping our promises. And then revenge. Jesus calls for a nonviolent resistance that turns the cheek, that gives more than demanded and goes further than required. Such a peacemaking response exposes the true motives of the oppressor and undermines their power. But Jesus takes it even further, all right? He's just not, he's not just calling us to be like Martin Luther King Jr. or Mahatma Gandhi. He says to love our enemies and pray for those who persecute you. It's one thing to love your friends, your kind neighbors. It's easy to love those who love you, but only a transformed heart could ever do this. I mean, not only does it seem counterintuitive, it seems absolutely nuts. Why would Jesus tell us to love our enemies? Because that's how he loved us. Romans 5:8 says, God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Our own hearts are changed because God loved us while we were still sinners, while we were still living as his enemies. And so when we love our enemies, it injects the life-giving, heart-changing power of the love of Jesus into the most hardened of hearts. And this becomes the only way to break the cycle of sin and selfishness. It is the only way to stop the dysfunctional spiral of revenge, resentment, bitterness, and one-upsmanship that otherwise consumes and destroys our relationships. And it opens the door for a new reality to take root and grow. That kind of change requires heart change. Your behavior, your words, your actions, your morality all flow from the heart. Proverbs 4:23 says, guard your heart above all else, for it determines the course of your life. Now let's be clear about what the Bible means when it talks about our hearts. Because when we as Americans talk about the heart and the mind, we're talking about our emotions and our intellect. Our heart is what we feel. Our mind is what we think. And we kind of have this view of these two forces, the emotions and the intellect, battling within us, and they pull us in one direction or the other. Some of us are more led by the heart. Others of us are more maybe cerebral and lead with what we think. But we have to be careful, though, in carrying that thinking over and applying it to the Bible as though that's what Matthew or Jesus is talking about when they use the word heart. Now, you probably would recognize the Greek word for heart. It's cardia. It's where we get words like cardiologist, cardiogram, cardiac arrest. And the ancient Greeks and the Jews that were a part of that Greco-Roman world of the first century, they used the word heart or cardia, just like we do, to refer to the physical organ. But they also used it, like we do, in a metaphorical sense. And when they talked about the heart in this figurative sense, it didn't just refer to the emotions. It represented the mind, the will, and the emotions. For instance, my Greek lexicon says that heart or cardia represents, quote, the essence of life in terms of thinking, willing, and feeling, the inner self, mind, thoughts, feelings, and being, end quote. In Luke 10:27, for instance, Jesus calls us, quote, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind. Now, Jesus here isn't carving up human nature into separate categories of emotion, spirit, body, and intellect. Rather, Jesus, he's making a point in a very Jewish way. Jews would repeat to emphasize. They would say the same thing over, but in different words. And that's what Jesus is doing here. He is saying the same thing with words that are interchangeable or have overlapping meanings to make a point. And what Jesus is saying here is love God with everything you've got. Now, in the interest of keeping you fully informed, if the Jews wanted to refer to their emotions and how they felt, do you know what body organ they used? It wasn't their heart. It was the bowels. in John 3 or 1 John 3:17, John talks about seeing a brother or sister in need, but having no pity or compassion on them. The ESV says it this way, closes his heart against them. But in the original Greek, it doesn't say closes his heart. What it literally says is, and shuts up his bowels from him. How dare you shut your bowels to your brother or sister? See, it doesn't carry over from one culture to another culture very well. Guys, try this. Look lovingly and longingly into your girl's eyes and tell her, I love you with all of my bowels, all 25 feet of them, and see how that works for you. So when the Bible talks about your heart, it's talking about something more than just what you feel. So when we say that true goodness or morality or righteousness requires a change of heart, that is a change of thinking, a change of feeling, and a change of desire. How does this happen? And here is the heart of the issue, pun intended. If our morality flows from our hearts, but something has gone terribly wrong with our hearts, then how can we ever be good? We can't change our own heart. A bad heart can't make a bad heart good, right? Can't do that. What it requires is heart surgery, right? And you can't do heart surgery on yourself. Right? Somebody has to do that for you. There has to be a physician, a great physician, to come in and do the heart surgery if it's going to be something like a heart transplant. And here's the thing. This is exactly what God is in the business of doing, of changing your heart. Only God can change our hearts. Simply put, we need Jesus to change our want to. Too often we think of morality in terms of ought to, but Jesus wants to deal with you on the level of want to. God doesn't want you to just do the right thing. He wants you to do the right thing because you love him and want to do what pleases him. And the one thing that can suddenly and totally transform the way somebody behaves is love. You will do things for someone you love that you won't do for anyone else. Love can transform the most menial of tasks into joy. Love can make you do things that you have never done before. That's the power of a changed heart. And that is the source of true righteousness. It's not that what you do doesn't matter, but what's changed is why you're doing it. God's expectations for our lives, for your life, haven't really changed. But what's changed is how we can rise to meet those expectations. When we place our faith in Jesus and we surrender our lives to him, the Bible tells us that his Spirit comes and inhabits our lives. And it uses different expressions. It talks about a circumcision of the heart, right? He comes away and he cuts the bad, diseased parts of our hearts. It talks about putting on a new self. And it transforms all those have-tos or can't-dos into get-to-dos, all right? It's no longer a list of all the things that I have to do or I can't do. It simply becomes what we desire because we desire him. We love him. And so what is our response? How do we seek to be good? Let me leave you with this. We need to focus on the who more than the what. Have you ever sworn off a bad habit, or sinful habit? You know, I will never bite my nails again. I'm never eating a whole box of Twinkies at once, ever again. I will never watch that. I will never do that. I will never go there. I will never say that. I will never take that. I will never drink that. All right? How many of us have sworn something off to never do it again, only to do it again? Or on the flip side, how many of us have promised to always do something? Right? I will run 3 miles a day. I will get my steps in. I will always respond with kind words. I will drink kale smoothies for breakfast. You know, I will pray every day. I will read my Bible every day. And how long does that last? Right? We mess up. If we're counting on the what to make us good, we will fall short. We need to focus on the who. And that who is Jesus. And Jesus can change your heart, and then that change of heart changes what you want to do, and so it changes what you do. And so whether you're not a Christian, and you're only now considering following Jesus for the first time, giving your life to Jesus for the first time, you need to look to Jesus. It's not a matter of, well, I need to go get my life together first. I need to go shape up. I need to get all these things out of my life, get cleaned up, you know, so that I can come to Jesus. No. You come to Jesus as a complete and total mess. It's okay. Just come to him, and he changes you from the inside out. And if that's a step you need to make, then call me. Text me, email me. My email address is on the church website. Email me. Let me know. I want to follow Jesus. I want to give my life to him. And I will contact you. I'll talk to you and lead you through that process. Or maybe you've been a Christian for a long time, but maybe you've looked away. You've begun loving other things, or you've begun focusing more on the what than the who. Now is the perfect time to fix your vision once again on who Jesus is and to be in love with him and focus on the who more than the what. And you can do that right now. Thank you, and God bless.